All right, everybody, here we go. Scott Burnside back with Two Man Advantage, the podcast. Pierre Lebrun, as always, in his construction zone of a house in Toronto. Now, Pierre, I will say, I don't hear too much hammering. Must be the holiday season. Are your workers taking a few days off? Or?
Yeah, the renovations are on hold during the holidays, so this will be a more peaceful taping of the Two Man Advantage podcast.
Well, speaking of peaceful, it's like an anti-segue, because joining us today, maybe the busiest hockey journalist over the last 72 hours, give or take, our very own Sean Shapiro in Big D in Dallas. I think the center of the hockey universe over the last 3 or 4 days. And Sean, you've been at the center of the storm, as it were. A lot to unpack with the Dallas Stars, with the biting commentary from CEO Jim Lights about Tyler Seguin and Jamie Benn. And then just to add a little icing to the cake, within a few hours of the taping of this podcast, news coming out that the Dallas Stars will in fact host Winter Classic in 2020. So lots to unpack here, but maybe just start right from the beginning. I know you wrote about it today, but walk us through briefly how this all unfolded, the storm that became Jim Light's commentary on Tyler Seguin and Jamie Benn. How'd that unfold for you?
Yeah, talk about a slow weekend, right, Scott?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, put your feet up, relax.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, all of this whole situation is amazingly bizarre, and I know people were having that reaction when they were reading what I wrote on Friday, and it's even more bizarre for me to think about as the person who was kind of in the middle of all of this. I mean, this really all started with. There's a text to me, to a couple other writers that cover the team as well, that Jim Lights wanted to talk around lunchtime on Friday, and he wanted to talk about general midpoint of the season stuff. And I assumed this was going to be just kind of the meeting where you'd go and maybe we'd talk a little bit about where the team is in the standings, talk about how other business things are going. Just the type of stuff that, okay, I'm going to take note of this, maybe put it in a story at some point. Did not expect it to be the display it turned into, where get over to his office, we walk in, even start with the, hey, how are your holidays? How was the family? And then, well, okay, I'm about to tell you about how bad Tyler Seguin and Jamie Benn are at their jobs. And then obviously everyone saw the comments and the result, and it was incredible to see A, that this happened, and B, that it was something where I was called in basically to talk to someone. And I feel bad for Stars PR person who actually went through and organized this meeting. Probably had no idea how far this was going to go. And I think about his weekend, to talk about busy weekends, as far as basically serving this right up to what it became.
So Pierre, I want to bring you in, and I want to know what you, I don't know where you were or if you read it on your phone or you were at home, but when you read those comments for the first time in Sean's piece, in the horse manure and all of the stuff, what goes through your mind? What are you thinking when you read it the first time?
I believe my retweet of Sean's piece at the time, and I was at TSN Friday. I was putting in a long shift to TSN, had a Habs game to do that night in the studio and a couple other shows. So the timing was kind of perfect, because we made a big deal of this on That's Hockey with Gino Retta and so on. But my tweet at the time was, okay, then. I didn't really know how else to react to it in the moment. But, I reached out to Stars owner Tom Gilardi that evening, as I'm sure Sean saw, and don't know that Tom Gilardi would have necessarily used some of the words that Jim Lights used, but in terms of the essence of the messaging, there's no question that Tom Gilardi is fully on board. A, he knew that Jim Lights was going to do this, and B, that the owner as well is disappointed with his top players. But again, that's where the story, I think, starts to have different layers, is that, and I think Jim Neal tried to address this yesterday, is that, you know, there's disappointment in their top players, but because of some of the profanity And obviously the passion of the moment that came out of the that Jim Leitz interview with Sean, a lot of the people were focusing on that just as much as the fact that they're disappointed with their top two players, if that makes any sense. Like, there was more than one story that came out of it, and I think some of that was not the intention. I think, you know, it's clear to me that they wanted this just to be about how rather honestly they were disappointed in their top two highly paid players, but the way in which Jim Leitz went through the roof of some of his language, I think went a bit too far.
Well, so Sean, let me ask you then, as this is unfolding with you, and I know you undressed some of these layers. I mean, there's a question about how does the media cover the Dallas Stars? And I think it, having spent a year there, it's a different marketplace. And until you're there, it's sometimes hard to understand just how vast a shadow the Dallas Cowboys cast over the entire sports media market there, but certainly for the Stars. I mean, it's a team who's missed the playoffs 8 of 10 years. They're on the bubble now. And I wonder if the timing of this is it surprising to you, or is this really the kind of commentary that's designed to push these players into an, I know several people said to me, listen, they're trying to make Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin uncomfortable in the hopes of getting better production for them and more consistent play given their stature. Were you surprised by the timing, or does this make sense to you if that's what they're trying to do?
The timing to me, it's interesting because it's something where we've seen behind the scenes, and I've heard comments like this off record about Jamie Benn's play and Tyler Seguin's play for a couple of weeks now. So the fact that that it bubbled to a public, I don't know if the timing, I don't know if it makes sense exactly with the timing as when it bubbled publicly, but it was the type of thing where obviously this was not something that's just been sitting there and all of a sudden Jim Leitz woke up on Friday morning and said, okay, I've just realized this now. This is something that they've been sitting on and they've been frustrated with for a while now. And it's also something where I think they thought, okay, we've tried everything. We've had our coaches have had meetings with the players. Our GM has had meetings with the players. And so finally it came down to Jim Leitz and Tom Gilardi essentially said, okay, well, you know what? We're going to try this now. We're going to see, we're paying the bills. We're paying the checks. Let's see if we can use this to motivate them. And the timing makes sense for if you were going to do this, the timing makes sense in the way, okay, it's 40 games. The Stars are only a couple points out from really actually almost competing for a third spot in the Central Division, which is amazing to say right now. When you think about something like this happening, you'd think it'd be a team that was 16 points away from a playoff spot, right? But they're around the halfway point of the season. They want to really dial things in. They want to, and I think they also want to try and prove like, oh, look, we do have the internal options to fix things and we can get that done in the second half of the season. And so that's where the timing of this all came into play of, okay, look, we can get things going. And also the schedule works out well for if you wanted to ever give a rant that could, quote unquote, inspire a team and make it look like there's possible, like it could play out well. It's you do it before you play Detroit, who's not a good hockey team. You do it before a stretch of 14 of 17 games at home. So it's something where it also gets people talking. And I know there's a lot of people who paid a bit more attention to the game the other night saying, how are Benn and Seguin going to react? And maybe that also leads to more people watching this stretch of just this team, both locally and nationally.
Yeah. Yeah. You've covered this game for a long time. I mean, you're not as old as I am, but you're not a young man anymore, my friend. Have you ever seen anything like this? And is it the kind of strategy that you think, I mean, what's the potential for it to work? What's the potential for it to backfire? What's your view on that?
I've never seen anything like this. I keep trying to think of and trying to figure if there's anything else like this. I haven't been able to find anything else like this. And I think if it's the biggest backfire, I think for management and it starts with Leitz's comments, where if Leitz makes his comments and they're in a more family friendly manner, it probably kind of ends there. I also don't know if Jamie Benn or Tyler Seguin ever really see those comments, because it's something where I think their attention was grabbed more by the vulgar language than anything. It's also the you take by with his language, he basically forced Jim Neal to come out and speak on Sunday. And in right. doing so, that led to that took away the security blanket Jim Neal had from this. So we could have looked at it as, okay, it's just the owner and Tom Gilardi, or just Tom Gilardi and Jim Leitz are upset. In doing his language and everything like that, it forced Jim Neal to get involved, and it forced Jim Neal to make public statements. And it led to even more of the conversation yesterday, where I even asked Jim Neal, where we're talking to Jim Neal, and he turns this on the media. And you mentioned the media market in Dallas, and it is an interesting media market because there really are only two independent voices that cover the team on a frequent basis, myself and the beat writer from the Dallas Morning News. The rest of the most of the team is covered by team media. There's two writers, there's a couple radio people, and the rest of the media market doesn't really show up and pay attention to the Stars. And in doing so, and kind of trying to blast these players, Jim Neal also goes and makes a statement of, oh, I want honesty, I want us to be reviewed. He also then turns this on back on him too, and it also puts more of a microscope on, okay, what has management done? What have the coaches done? What have everything? I think for them, they thought they were going to try and put the microscope on just Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin. And what they did was they put it on all of them. And that was not the intention when they sent Jim Leitz to, when Jim Leitz called me into his office.
But I would say this, Sean, I hope that you didn't take it personally what Jim Neal said. I don't think, I took it to mean that it's not about the fact there's only, you know, two people covering the team. More or less, I think the point is, I think what he was trying to say, and this is how I took it, is that in other markets, the pressure to perform and the level of you know, the volume of criticism is at a whole other level, that it makes players more accountable, and that's just a fact. I mean, you know, John Tavares signs the biggest contract in Toronto Maple Leafs history. And comes to this market in Toronto, and that's not to say that it's because of the pressure that exists when you're a Toronto Maple Leaf, because I think John Tavares is a self-starter. But the point is, if he wasn't doing what he was doing right now for $11 million a year, he would be hearing about it. I mean, and again, it's not that people covering the Leafs are any smarter. They're not. It's just the volume. It's just they're just more voices and more people, and it creates a kind of noise. That you get in Montreal and Boston and Philly and Vancouver and all these places that you just don't naturally have in Dallas for sheer lack of numbers, right? I mean that's essentially, I think, what he was saying.
Yeah, and that's that's how I read into it too. And it's interesting too, because it's a commentary on the market he's in, and it's a commentary on, as you said, in Toronto or Vancouver. I mean, if this was happening, someone would write about it. Someone would be talking about it on a radio. It would be in the vocabulary of not just the media, but everyone all the time. The Stars players have a bit of a luxury where they have, if they don't turn on sports talk radio for the 10 minutes they talk about it, and they don't read about it, they're likely going to avoid it because they're not going to run across people who bring it up to them anyway.
Well, yeah. So I remember it was years ago when Mike Keenan was coaching in Florida, and I remember a comment he made is very much along these lines, and it wasn't about a specific player, at least I don't remember it that way, but just this notion that when a player leaves the rink in Florida, and to your point, Sean and Pierre, there isn't this sort of organic pressure in outside the rink to be better or to be accountable, and it doesn't exist in some of these marketplaces, and I think it's fair to say that it doesn't exist in Florida right now. And I think that's, you know, that I guess, well, let's I want to move on and talk about the Winter Classic and what that means to this franchise and how important it is. But Pierre, let me start with you. At the end of the day, do you think this works? At the end of the day, will we remember this at the end of the season because the Stars make the playoffs and it'll be seen as a turning point, or maybe they don't? How do you think this plays out in terms of a long-term impact on this team?
Well, I mean, going back to your question, I think your question earlier about how old I was meant for me, and Sean took it, but I don't blame him because Sean's in the middle of the maelstrom right now, so he should be taking all these questions. But I've covered the NHL for 24 years, as you know, Scotty, and nothing compares to what happened here, to Sean's point. But I will say this. there are things that have happened in those 24 years that we still talk about today, even if they're not at the level of this. And I'll give you an example. You know, the San Jose Sharks have been a model franchise forever. But there's been ups and downs. And the stripping of the captaincy of both Patrick Marleau and Joe Thornton during this amazing, you know, really 20-year run in San Jose are still things that people remember. And that's not nearly as controversial as what just transpired here. But my point is, if those are things that we still remember and still talk about, you can just imagine how this will be remembered forever, because it's at a whole other level. And really, to me, we'll ultimately find out how Jamie Benn, Tyler Seguin feel about this franchise as time goes on. I mean, do they take this, and this I'm sure is what Jim Leitz hopes, do they take this and be like the guys in Major League, the movie, and say, let's rally around as players against ownership and play for each other? That would be a great thing for the Dallas Stars, you know? But they could also turn around, and not necessarily both of them, maybe one or the other, and say, you know, screw everyone. I'm going to go through the motions here, and you owe me big money, and I'll just do my own thing. So I think, you know, I think we'll see how they respond. I've always been, as you know, Scotty, a huge Jamie Benn fan, and just love the way he plays, especially when he plays with an edge. But it is absolutely accurate to say that he hasn't been quite as effective in the last 2 years as he was before. And part of that is the lofty standard that he set for himself. But, you know, are we going to see that player again? And I suspect we will.
All right. So, Sean, what's your gut? You're there every day and you've seen the ebbs and flows. And I mean, you and I were around last year when they went from a virtual playoff lock at the beginning of March to basically done like dinner at the end of a 6-game winless road trip that turned into an 8-game winless stretch. What's your gut tell you? Is this the defining moment for this team and those players in terms of reaching their potential and driving this team into the playoffs, which I know degrees of whether this team is as good as the one that won the Central Division 3 years ago or not, but they should have been in the playoffs last year. They were good enough. And I think they're good enough to be a playoff team this year, but what's your gut tell you? Is this a defining moment on a positive side or a negative side?
It's a tough call. I mean, I think the interesting thing in all of this, and I think Pierre's point about the Sharks captaincy is a great one, because you think about the Sharks, and when this all came together, I remember having a conversation with somebody about they brought up the Sharks captaincy thing. And I don't even remember off the top of my head, I can't remember which years the Sharks captaincy thing happened, but that's something that's always in my mind when I think about the Sharks. And so just to Pierre's point, this is something that'll follow the franchise around and it's not going anywhere. As for this season, I think it's something that I think Tyler Seguin was probably going to improve either way. I think while he has hit a lot of posts and there are parts of his game that could be better, I do think that he was going to improve either way. I think he was going to get a little bit more lucky. He wasn't going to be shooting as low as he was. And so I think that was naturally going to happen. And so I think there's going to be some credit given to this rant about why Tyler Seguin got better. The interesting thing to me is whether Jamie Benn gets better or not, because I think Jamie Benn, we really haven't seen Jamie Benn take over games like he could. 2-3 years ago, Jamie Benn would take over games and he would be that guy who you would watch him play. And he was the guy who that night, the Dallas Stars were not going to lose because of Jamie Benn. And we don't really see that guy for full 60-minute games anymore. We see him maybe for 10-minute stretches. We see it maybe in a period. So the fascinating thing to me is what happens with Jamie Benn, because Jamie Benn's a guy who he's going to be 30 this year. He's a guy who plays a physical style, and he's got that. And his contract, can he live up to his contract and be paid that way with how his game kind of goes with his age? It's going to be really interesting to see where Jamie goes. And I think that is going to define whether or not this was a positive or negative. If Jamie Benn all of a sudden somehow finds the Sochi bump out of this, then you know what? This is the greatest thing in the world for the Stars. If he doesn't, it just creates more issues that maybe come up later in the future when people start thinking about, okay, do I want to go to the Stars just long-term? Like, hey, I'm a free agent on July 1st. do I want to go play for that franchise? And this, that'll be in people's heads. So I realize I kind of dodged the question slightly, but I think my gut
slightly.
Says, yeah, slightly. But
I wonder, Sean, since we have you on, I'm working the Montreal Dallas game tonight in studio at TSN. Good old, no better way to spend New Year's Eve than a little Stars Habs matchup. And, you know, one player that I'm thinking about, just as you talked about free agency, is Alexander Radulov, who, of course, left the Habs for Dallas a couple of Julys ago and essentially was offered the same contract in both cities, although I think only reluctantly by the Canadiens after Dallas first offered it, as memory serves. But how do you think, I wonder if he would ever be willing to admit, I mean, do you think he's still happy with his decision? Because I can tell you that there was something about the way he played in Montreal, and this goes back almost to the Jim Neal argument about the media thing, but I mean, he played like his pants were on fire in Montreal. I mean, he just, there was something about the crowd, and he talked about it at the time, about playing in that atmosphere at the Bell Center, where he was the most noticeable player almost every night for the Montreal Canadiens that year. And I know he's had a lot of good games for the Dallas Stars, but from afar, I don't watch all the Dallas Stars games, but I've certainly watched him from time to time. I don't know that we've seen the same Radulov since he left. I mean, what's your take on that?
This season's been interesting because when Radulov has been fully healthy, he's been that guy. He's been the person you had to watch on the ice. He's been dynamic. He makes hockey fun. I also think, and I think this goes into Ben, he's playing with Ben and Sagan quite a bit. I think he also has some frustrations with Ben and Sagan too. I think we see it in Radulov's play. It's something Radulov would never say. I think he's a guy who, when you watch Radulov play, he works so hard every single shift. He tracks pucks, he digs pucks out, he does all of that stuff. And there is a bit of energy lacking from Ben. And when there's the energy lacking from Ben and Sagan, I think you start to see some more frustration. I don't know the exact correlation, but I think if you went and Scott knows the Alexander Radulov hooking call well from last season. I think if you went and you kind of looked, I think there might be more. He might end up getting those more of those frustrations, more of those penalty takes might probably come in those games where Ben and Sagan aren't playing up to his level and his energy. So I don't think he's regretting his decision, but I do think he is. He's frustrated as well with the team because he came here and he came to Dallas assuming he was the piece that was going to be part of a team that was going to be one of the best teams in the Western Conference. And you can't say they have been in the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm. All right. Just before we let Sean go and we bring to a close the first segment of Two Man Advantage, the podcast, of course, this is all the backdrop. You know, this story now becomes the backdrop to, you know, terrific news, really, for the franchise and for the marketplace with the news that the Dallas Stars will, in fact, host the Winter Classic. So, in fact, who knows, depending on staffing, and the three of us could be preparing for New Year's Eve in Dallas a year from now, getting ready for the Winter Classic. And, Sean, I wonder how important is it to be given an outdoor game like this, and certainly the Winter Classic is the centerpiece of all outdoor games on the NHL calendar from year to year. And I wonder how important is this, and does it take away from it, given what's happened over the last 3 or 4 days? Does it take some of the luster off this announcement?
It certainly leads to some. Like when we saw it was first came out today and we saw some of the reactions. I mean, I don't think the Stars envisioned getting the Winter Classic and then people's first reaction being, well, again, are they going to play against Jim Lights? Because that was one reaction I saw, because the tweet was worded, don't know who the Stars will play against. And someone said, well, they're probably playing against the CEO. So this is for the Stars. This is supposed to be kind of a defining moment for the franchise. This is one of those where especially from a business side, and something where one of the reasons they really got this, and it's something that the Stars are really proud of, is one of the reasons they got this is how well they handled the draft, earlier this year. It was, the NHL was really happy with how they handled things. During that time, that was when the NHL started looking into doing an outdoor game in Dallas. And not only did the Stars get an outdoor game, because we've seen outdoor games in LA and San Jose and everything like that, this is the first time the marquee outdoor game is actually leaving one of those core traditional markets. Like, this is the farthest south an outdoor game will be played in NHL history, I think. I mean, I'm not sure what's farther south, and I'm not sure whether we count the weird Vegas preseason game or not. But this is huge for the franchise, and this is something where, as I was told by one of the front office people, they're not in the hierarchy where they want to be in coverage in Dallas. And obviously it's a Cowboys town, but they also want to be treated like a big market team, and big market teams are supposed to get events like this and get the draft. And if they can handle this well, and I think the big test is going to be them selling it out, because I think that's something where with the market they're in, that's going to be the huge scrutiny of, okay, will the people show up? If they can, it'll be something that is really good for the franchise. It's also something that, if they can't fill that stadium, people are going to look at it, and it's not going to be a look. That's not going to be a good look.
And by the way, how about them Cowboys? I mean, let's make sure we mention that. But you know, we mentioned, you know, San Jose. The reason I bring up San Jose a lot in some of my conversations, the Sharks of all the non-traditional markets, and I guess I would say Tampa Bay and San Jose over the last 20 years. Have been these unbelievable franchises in terms of how you should be, how your franchise can be the best it can be, given that they're in a non-traditional market. I mean, the Lightning and the Sharks, competitively, stability, and you know, since Jeff Finnick took over the Lightning and Steve Yzerman, the way they draft and develop. San Jose forever, really from day one, stability of ownership, stability of Doug Wilson as GM. So that's how every non-traditional market team wants to be, is like the way the Lightning and Sharks are, right? And so I think my point with the Stars is that, and I'm going to say this as diplomatically as I can, but I'm sure, and Sean lives this, and you were there last year, Scotty, it's sometimes like an invisible franchise at times. Not just in its market. I mean, you're always going to be lesser than the Cowboys in your own market. But I mean, league wide, it's not a franchise that's created enough waves or had enough of a presence. It's just sort of a franchise. It's just there, and that's not good enough. I'm sure it's not good enough when you're Tom Gilardi, the owner. You want to have a franchise that carries more weight, that wins more games, that has more buzz, that has more people talking about them. And the reality is they've just not been that franchise for a long time.
Well, I would argue that was why last year was so disappointing for that team, because I thought that they had, and not just because I was there, although you draw your own conclusions, but no, I thought last year with the hiring of Ken Hitchcock, which, you know, as it turned out, there were some flaws of that. It didn't work out the way people had thought, but you have Ken Hitchcock there, you sign Alexander Radulov, you have Tyler Seguin, who is emerging as one of the most exciting offensive players in the NHL, you have Jamie Benn, who is an elite player, John Klingberg steps to the fore with a legitimate discussion about, you know, with his inclusion in the Norris Trophy discussion. All those things were happening, and I thought, to your point, Pierre, that team, I thought, you know, through about 60 games, that team was tracking the right way. I mean, you think 2 years ago and when Patrick Sharp was there and they won the division, and maybe this is building to what you were talking about. And when they collapsed in March, and frankly, when Ben Bishop got hurt, and yes, there were a lot of excuses, but frankly, they didn't get the leadership that they needed at critical times, and it fell apart. And you know, I think you're right, Pierre. This is a franchise that is searching for something more than what they have, and now they have this golden opportunity to play on the NHL's biggest regular season stage with the Winter Classic next year. And you know, hopefully, if they do what they are capable of doing, and they're a playoff team, maybe this starts them in the right direction. But I think you're right, Pierre. It's been, there's no question, there's a huge level of frustration with this franchise and where they're at. So normally I don't give the last word to anyone but myself, but Sean, you have been doing yeoman work for The Athletic and terrific job in a very difficult and pressure situation. don't know. What I'll ask you a simple question. Do you think the Stars make the playoffs? Are they a playoff team come mid-April?
Do I think the Stars make the playoffs? I think,
not to put you on the spot here.
I think they get in as the second wild card. I don't know if they do anything with it, but I think they get in as the second wild card. And I can make the case one way or the other, but to put me on the spot, I'll go with a second wild card spot, and maybe that smooths some things over. And either way, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens the first time they lose a game after all of these comments, because they won the other night. And I'm fascinated to see what happens the rest of the year.
Yeah, good stuff. All right. Well, terrific work by you, Sean Shapiro of The Athletic in Dallas. And Pierre, always good work, but your work here is not yet done. So don't go anywhere. As always, we'll return in just a moment with the second segment of Two Man Advantage, the podcast. Sean, have a great new year and keep up the good work, my friend. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, happy holidays, guys.
All right, as promised, here we are back for the second segment, Two Man Advantage, the podcast. This is the last one of 2018, Pierre. Are you feeling a little nostalgic, or, you know, how are you feeling as we head into the final hours of 2018 and looking ahead to 2019?
Well, hours away from 2019 here as we tape this today. It's very exciting. Can I say that I don't feel like horse shit? Is that is it too early?
It's too early. I don't think it's ever too early to say that. And and I've never thought that of you. That's the great thing. Like, in all the years I've known you, I've never said, you know what? He's like that. So no, that's good. But I want to ask you, where do you think we were exactly 11 years ago now? It took me a while to do the actual math on it, but 11 years ago, right now, do you remember where we were? What do you think we were doing?
I think, were we not in Buffalo, New York, on the eve of the first ever Winter Classic?
Yeah, see, that's why it's nice to work with a pro like you, right? I didn't even have to tell you. I didn't text you to warn you I was going to ask you this. But you're right. I was thinking about it today, and it's been a couple of years since I've been to a Winter Classic. And I've been seeing our pal Joey Mack is at Notre Dame getting ready for the big game between Boston and Chicago on New Year's Day. And I'm a bit nostalgic for it, and I wonder. You know, 11 years, that's a long time, and it's a long time for this property to be going. And I wonder what you remember about, as we were getting ready for really what was completely unknown, right? Like, we had no idea what it was going to look like. We had no idea whether anyone was going to show up. Would they have fun? What would the game be like? And I wonder what do you remember what you were sort of thinking going into that game, which turned out to be sort of a seminal event, I think, in terms of event planning for the NHL, and really did, I think it was an important moment for the NHL in terms of its profile and thinking outside the box and those kinds of things.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I do remember how much folks at the league were kind of holding their breath heading into that day because of the weather and whether or not the game was actually going to be played. And I think there was a lot more stress around that than anyone actually kind of let on at the time, Scott. That's what I remember. And you wonder, looking back, had there been a postponement that day? And I think the reason there was risk of that, if you remember, is that it was snowing quite heavily.
Yeah.
Which produced sort of that, you know, magical, you know, look where Sidney Crosby scores in the snow in the shootout to win it. Over the Sabres, it looked terrific, but certainly in terms of visibility because of the snow, I think a lot of people are holding their breath that first day. And I, you know, looking back, had there been a postponement, would this whole thing have, you know, and I forgive me for the pun here, would this whole event would have snowballed into what it's become if there's a hitch the first time? You know, if there would have been a hitch, would everyone have been in such a hurry to keep doing more and more and more? I know it sounds weird to say that, but I do think the first one is important, that it all sort of happens without anything negative. And more or less, that's what happened. And I think that was important for the league.
Yeah, well, and I mean, you sort of think back, and it really was in some ways the dark ages when it came to outdoor games, because it was before the NHL had their portable ice machine, and you know, where they're able to really go across. Well, I think they have two of them now, and so they can crisscross the continent. I was at an outdoor game at Dodger Stadium a few years later, and it was beautiful. It was one of my favorite outdoor games. And I think to your point, at that very first game, and I know Canadian fans will be having their hands up, oh, there was the Heritage Classic in Edmonton, but this was the first, you know, New Year's Day. This was the big deal for the NHL to unveil the first Winter Classic, and having Sidney Crosby and the Penguins come into Buffalo. And you're right. I mean, the ice conditions by the end of it, remember, they were shoveling the snow every 5 or 6 or 7 minutes. The ice was breaking down because it was so cold. And I saw a highlight just recently of Crosby scoring that shootout winner. And the snow is like, he looks like a snowplow, right? The snow is coming up off his stick. No wonder Ryan Miller couldn't make the stop. Probably couldn't see the puck. So you're right. I think there is sort of a fine line when you go back to that what if it doesn't go that way? Or what if, you know, what if they have to, you know, they have to stop the game or whatever it is. I think you're right. I think history maybe views this event completely differently. And instead it's something that's, you know, it's a marquee event. And let me ask you this. Are you jaded by it now? I mean, maybe after 11 years, certainly the newness is different, right? How could it not be? But do you feel much differently about the Winter Classic now, or what's your take on it?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have the same buzz that it once did. I think now it's become an event that is special where it is on site. But it's no longer, it's absolutely no longer an event, I think, where fans across the league feel they have to stop everything and tune into. I just think some of that had dissipated, and predictably so. It's not the end of the world. In fact, a couple of days ago when I started hearing again about the setup for the Winter Classic in Notre Dame, I actually had to look up which teams were in it, but I should have known. I should have known Chicago was in it, because I think that's a rule that the Blackhawks have to be in every single Winter Classic. But I actually had forgotten, seriously, what teams were in it. But yeah, I think, you know, for the fans of those two teams and for people that, you know, are there this year, I think it'll feel special. And I think for people tuning in, it'll be, I'll watch a few minutes, but then I'll probably watch something else. I mean, I just don't think it gravitates like it did before.
Yeah. All right. So I got a couple of things I want to ask you about before we close out the final Two-Man Advantage podcast of 2018. But do you have do you have a favorite Winter Classic memory? You and I did a bunch right in a row, right? We every year that was sort of a thing. We were going to be on the road and we were going to be at the Winter Classic because it was that important. And of course, the second year they went to Wrigley, and that was Chicago and Detroit. And before Chicago really sort of had ascended to the top of the NHL mountain. And so is there a moment that sticks out for you on or off the ice? I mean, maybe it was just the Sterling company you were keeping, but is there one that stands out for you?
I think the year that I was in Ann Arbor and Detroit and Toronto hooked up, I just think the magnitude of the big house and just the way it looked that day, I remember thinking, oh my goodness. And I think half the crowd were Leaf fans who had come across the border. And I just thought it was just, it just looked amazing that day. You know, so many fans. Two original six teams and a fun game. And probably that would be the one for me. Boston, Montreal in Foxborough was pretty cool too. But I'd say probably the one in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. And I think for me, there were a couple, right? I had never been to Fenway before the game there. I think that was Philly Boston the first time there. But I think for me, the one that I enjoy and I think back quite often is Citizens Bank Park in Philadelphia, Rangers and Flyers, and part of it was the alumni game. Bernie Parent and seeing Bob Clark and Eric Lindros on the ice together. And I think you wrote quite a piece on just what that meant for both those, you know, sometimes combatants over the years to appear together as part of the alumni squad for the Flyers. And I think there were like 45,000 people watching that alumni game. That was pretty cool. And of course, at the end of the Winter Classic, which might have been one of the most dramatic, because if I'm not mistaken, Danny Briere had a penalty shot in the final minute and was stopped by Henrik Lundqvist, and the Rangers won the game. And then John Tortorella complained immediately after the game that he thought the referees were trying to fix the match. And I remember you and I at the back of the press conference room looking at each other. We're like, wait a minute, didn't they just win? Didn't the Rangers win this game? And John Tortorella was all over that, but I believe he was fined subsequently for his comments, but that's the one that sticks out for me. It was a pretty dramatic game, and but lots of fun over the years for those. So, and I'm pleased to have spent many of those Winter Classic days and nights with you. All right, a couple things just before we wrap up here. I was curious what you made of a couple of deals made by Edmonton GM Peter Chiarelli, trying to get the Oilers, the slumping Oilers, back on track, acquiring some defensive help. Just looking at the actual numbers here, Petrovic coming to Edmonton from Florida. And sort of more curiosity part of the double dealing with Brandon Manning, another defenseman coming over to Edmonton, of course, familiar to Edmonton fans as he was the player who checked Connor McDavid out of his rookie season, sending him into the boards with a shoulder, collarbone injury, I guess, in Connor McDavid's rookie season. Do you see this as, I think Peter Chiarelli himself said, you know, these are not sexy players, but they're players that are important for trying to solidify the defensive structure of the Oilers. What do you make of these deals just before the end of the calendar year?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think that, they're not huge trades. I mean, these are both third pairing type defensemen that the Oilers picked up, but they were desperate. I mean, they were desperate because ever since Klefbom and Oscar Klefbom and Chris Russell went down, I believe the Oilers have given up 31 goals in 7 games since then, and a pile of games where they're giving up 40 or more shots. And so they were absolutely leaking defensively. The oil work, get it. And so I think it speaks to really the desperation of the moment. Again, I don't know that I think we'll look back at the end of the year and not really spend too much time on these two trades. But you understand in the moment what they're trying to do. They need a couple of live bodies with experience who can come in and try and play some steady minutes. But again, these aren't top pairing guys. Manning and Petrovic, but yeah, they're guys I think that Ken Hitchcock will have a bit of trust in. And I think a lot of this is just to trying to find a bit of defensive hold here, because the Oilers have really kind of stepped back ever since. I mean, Klefbom is it's impossible to replace that guy. I mean, he was playing unbelievable hockey for the Oilers, and his absence in particular has really been felt, I think.
Yeah, which I will say this. So it's interesting. We spent a lot of time in the first segment talking about Dallas and all the things that are going on there. But you know, the whole Central Division is kind of whacked now, right? I mean, you've got Winnipeg who are sitting on top as we're chatting now. Nashville has been slumping. Now they did come up with a huge win, actually, literally while you and I were chatting. They finished off a victory in Washington, huge win for them over the defending Stanley Cup champions, but have really been struggling. Of course, Philip Forsberg still out of action, so they've been missing him. Colorado is in, you know, they've won 2 in regulation of their last 10. They're 2-6-2 in their last 10, struggling there. Winnipeg, we mentioned there, Dustin Byfuglien is going to be lost for a month, maybe more. So that there is sort of a, I don't know where, you know, maybe it's just the ebbs and flows of the season, but do you see this? Is it sort of a change where you look at the Central in a little bit different view, and maybe does it open doors for, you know, sort of wild card possibilities in the, you know, whether it's Edmonton or Minnesota or even Vancouver, shout out on this very day by New Jersey. But do you look at the Central any differently than you might have at the start of the season?
Well, I don't know if I look at the Central any differently, but going back to Edmonton and the Pacific, I look at the Pacific differently because I thought in the opening 5-6 weeks that the Pacific was so behind and you know, seemingly no one, you know, getting any traction in the Pacific. And then a bunch of teams took off. I mean, that division, it looks so different now. And, you know, Calgary leading the way, but San Jose's finally found its footing, which is less surprising. But Vegas has, after a really an opening month in which the Golden Knights could do no right, and now can do no wrong again. And so those are the three teams at the top. But then behind there, you got a surprising Canucks team. You got the Oilers that are still have a shot at making it. So, you know, that you know, Anaheim can't score, but they're getting Vezina Trophy goaltending from John Gibson when he's healthy. So that Pacific division has shown a lot. really, since mid to late November, a lot of teams have taken off there, which makes the task even more difficult for an Oilers team to try and get in, because there's lots of competition just within their own group to come out of it. And I think, again, you know, they're not sexy trades. They're not big names. And I don't know how much of a difference those two guys are going to make, but it speaks to the urgency of the moment that Peter Chiarelli is trying to salvage some points here, because every point's going to matter all the way to the end for Edmonton.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's funny, you mentioned the Vezina and you mentioned John Gibson. Obviously, his play so important for a Ducks team that really they really do struggle to score and have gone through, you know, a host of injuries and different issues there. And I really enjoyed your, I'm not just saying this because, you know, I have to say it, but I really enjoyed your mid-season awards piece, which came out on The Athletic 2 or 3 days ago. And I love those kinds of stories because it makes you think about, well, where you know, which players are trending which way, and what kinds of surprises have we seen. And I'm curious, when you were putting that together, which trophy gave you the most pause? Which trophy, when you were like, okay, here are my 4 or 5 guys, which one gave you the most difficulty?
I'd say the Norris. I really, and I know a lot of Leaf fans are aggravated with me that I didn't give the Norris to Morgan Riley. I certainly gave a lot of thought to doing so, and I may end up doing so. The beauty of doing this at the holiday break is how much a lot of it is subject to change before you actually vote for real come April, obviously, because so much of the season's still to be played out. But I think debating between Morgan Riley and Mark Giordano gave me a lot of pause for thought. And there's other great defensemen having great years, Chris Letang in Pittsburgh, and, you know, Ryan McDonough. I made the point that guys like McDonough no longer ever get mentioned. It's like Vlasic in San Jose over the years, that, you know, the great shutdown guys. You know, unless you're filling the net, it seems like no one wants to think about you for the Norris. But McDonough's playing outstanding hockey for the Tampa Bay Lightning, the first place Lightning. But really, to me, it comes down to Riley or Giordano at the moment. And it's really, you know, it's really tough to pick. I think they're both excellent choices.
Yeah, no. And, you know, Mark, it's interesting tracking both Mark Giordano and the Flames, because it was 2 or 3 years ago, and he was, I believe it was a biceps injury late in the season, but he was poised, you know, was having a terrific offensive season, but was also really had, I think, opened a lot of people's eyes to his versatility and his complete game on the back end for the Flames, and had the injury and probably cost him at least maybe a spot on the final ballot for the Norris. And then there were a couple off years at coaching change. You know, Bob Hartley left and Glenn Gulletson comes in. And, of course, now Bill Peters there. But I think you're right. And the Flames, for me, are one of the surprise teams. I just thought they'd be a bubble team. And here they are, as we're chatting today, plus 26, sitting in first place, tied in points, but have 3 games in hand on Vegas atop the Pacific. And I think they're a fun team to watch, but they're the real deal defensively as well, and Jerdan was a huge part of that. So I can see where you're coming from with that. So did you get a lot? So were Leaf fans outraged? I think Leaf fans are given to outrage now when people they feel that people don't give them enough credit. Were they outraged?
Somewhere, yeah. And the funny thing is, I just love some of the commentary sometimes. And listen, fans are passionate. I love it. If they weren't, we wouldn't be able to do what we do for a living. So God bless them. But I think one of the comments was another typical anti-Leaf bias from Daryl LeBron, which came within the same 24 hours of another reader complaining that all I do is write about the Leafs. So it was funny, as they say, in the eye of the beholder, what people think of you sometimes.
All right. And you know what? I actually make notes to myself as we lead up to podcast time. And I made a note to myself several weeks ago. And, you know, we get going and then it's over. And then I say, oh, I wish I'd asked that. But so before we close out the final episode of Two Man Advantage, the podcast, there's been a lot of discussion about goal songs and some of the teams are having goal songs. And I thought, well, I want to know, what's Pierre LeBrun's goal song? So whether you were playing in the NHL and scored a goal, or maybe it's just when you write a phenomenal piece and your goal song, what would you pick? I want to know. I have a guess. I have a guess.
I was going to say, you know what my ringtone was for many years. and the only reason it isn't now is I haven't figured out how to download it on my new phone. But obviously the Brass Bonanza. Come on.
The greatest
goal song in the history of the sport. And by the way, I know Hurricanes fans are kind of torn by the whole Whalers night thing. And I get it. You know, I mean, I think it was our colleague Arpin Basu in Montreal that made the point that as an Expos fan, he probably would have been outraged if the Washington Nationals had ever had an Expos night. But I don't know. To me, what can I say? I view it obviously a lot more neutrally because I'm you know, not a fan of any team, but I just love the Brass Bonanza, and it brings back great memories of you know, watching the Whalers in the 80s and loving that song when they scored. It's just a great song, and absolutely hearing that song that night on December 23rd when the Hurricanes beat the Bruins, it was amazing the way it sounded and the way the crowd reacted to it through the TV screen. I absolutely love it. I mean, I tweeted this, and much to the, again, this must be my thing these days, but I think much to the angst of a lot of Hurricanes fans. But I would make this their goal song permanently, but I know it's not going to happen because, again, Hurricanes fans don't want all things Whalers to be permanent.
Well, I'll tell you, if it came down to the fact that they won every single game while they were wearing an old retro Whalers jersey, they might put up with it for a team that hasn't been to the playoffs since 09. But the wins have been difficult to come by for the Canes. So they may have to go back to the Brass Bonanza more often if they want to stay in the playoff hunt. And I knew that you were going to, but I figured you would pick that. I thought you might go with Fireworks from the Hip, but no, I'm with you. Yeah, so that's a good choice for you. So, all right, friend.
Although my ringtone now on my phone is Little Bones from the Tragically Hip. So there you go. Okay. So you do really know me more than people realize.
That's a bit horrifying, actually. So, all right, my friend. Well, listen, the best of 2019 to come for you, and look forward to, as I always do, to chatting with you. And next time we do, it'll be a new year, and we'll be moving forward. But always a pleasure, my friends, and happy new year to you and to your family.
Right on, right on. Same to you, brother.